We also do archaeological field work for the Department of Transportation, and it was in connection with this that we came across the mills in Alpha and everything else that they were doing before. The initial survey indicated that there might be some mill remains north of Tankers and Pond, or north of Talca Pond, and sure enough, there were. At that point, the entire area was heavily wooded. When I say heavily wooded, not obviously not first growth, but heavily wooded nonetheless. And so we laid out the area as best we could that was going to be, was part of the old mill structure. And at that point, came to an agreement with the Department of Transportation that they would back off with their highway, which they had their slope. Their initial design for the slopes was that they were going to cover the head brace, so they were going to cover part of the old mill buildings and everything else. We got them to push their mill, push their highway taking lines back toward the highway now, and that's the part you see that is at the wall. Leaving the mill structures, even though the buildings have gone, leaving the mill structures themselves, the foundations and everything untouched. Let me briefly run through the history of the Dobson Mill and the Boyne Company Mill, and then maybe a little bit about the use of preservation laws and directives so that you can, I don't know how much of this you know or not. Having sat on the National Register Board for 10 or 12 years, I'm very familiar with the kind of work you're doing, and you, believe me, you are very fortunate to have someone to do this. This is a process which normally, from start to finish, on a historic district, if it's going to go through the evaluators that are provided by the Historic Commission, normally takes anywhere from 2 to 4 years on its own, and generally speaking, it's a lot of work. You are extremely fortunate to have people like you who will do it for you. The mill itself. Now, I'm not, the mills that I'm talking about are not the mills in Talcottville, not the lower end of Talcottville. The mills I'm talking about started out by being connected with that because the John Warburton House is in Talcottville, and he had initially two houses, I gather. One of which, in one of which, he set up a carding machine. Now, carding, in making cloth, one takes wool from a sheep, combs it or tards it so that the fibers all run one way, and this is a very brief and incomplete description of it, but gets the fibers all to run one way, then twists the fibers into a yarn, and then weaves the yarn, and then finishes the material. So much for the process of making. I spent a year and a half in a textile industry, a textile in a university in England. See, that's what I did. I can reduce the whole year and a half. John Warburton had a carding machine. Along comes Peter Dobson and said, we could do better than that. We could start to spin our own yarn as well as to cart it. So Peter Dobson went upstream on the Tankerhusen up to Dobson Road. At Dobson Road, the big stone dam was not there. There was a small dam and it's a sawmill there. The pond was there, not as large as it is today, but the initial pond was there. Peter Dobson then leased part of the water output from that dam that was running the sawmill, and set up a mill building. This is the building, these are the set of foundations that are immediately west of Dobson Road, on the south side, southwest of the Tankerhusen. This mill was theoretically to take the wool that was carded by Warburton and spin it and then set it out to the individual homes in the area which would then have their hand looms, their attic looms, their whatever, and at this point people would spin the take the yarn, weave the yarn in the home looms, and then bring it back to a fulling mill. The fulling mill would then, fulling mill being the mill that used fuller's earth, if you will, but processed clean by thumping it around, clean the cloth after it'd been through all the processes. And the cloth was always fold after it was woven. Peter Dobson then set up the mill to do that initially, as I understand it. Let me go back to this. When he, in 1814, he had, oh no, October 1813, a list of the equipment that was in that mill as of 1813 was they had a water wheel, three turning legs, two carding machines, one drawing frame, one rotating machine, two mules, which are actually the spinning. The mules are the mule spinning with which replaced the old spinning jenny. But these mules actually are a whole series of spindles with the yarn woven on them, and a carriage that moves out back and forth on rollers. And what it does is it takes one from one spindle, takes the yarn off, and spins it as it goes about two-thirds of the way out, pulls it out, draws it out, and then it locks this part, and then puts the rest of the twist in it as it goes the other third of the way, and then winds it on the bobbin, and then goes all the way back. Each one of these mules in the Dobson mill had 192 spindles, and that wasn't it. If you look at any of the larger mills, for instance, any of the mills in Massachusetts, Lawrenceville, any of the mills that are up there, you measure the capacity of a mill in spindles, and the Atlantic mill had something like 23,000 spindles. Many of the Massachusetts, Lowell, Lawrence, and so forth had thousands and thousands and thousands of spindles. But they were later. They were considerably later than this 1813 mill, which had, I say, two mules with 192 spindles in each. It had a throstle with 42 spindles, and that is nothing more than a machine that tightens, if you will, tightens the fibers that are in it. It had a twisting machine, which meant that you could take yarn and double it if you wanted to. If you needed some, you could double that and so forth. It had three reels, a whipping frame, and some other things. Peter Dobson and his friends then turned over the operation of this mill, actually quit claimed it, to the Tankahoosen Cotton Company. And all of a sudden, now we see the switch from a completely wool-oriented mill to a mill that was a cotton. And at this point, you're talking, in all probability, you're talking about the introduction of a cassimere, which is a cloth which has a cotton warp and a wool weft. Cloth has warp threads and weft threads. Generally speaking, the warp threads are stronger than the warp threads are stronger than the weft threads. But if you're in your weaving, you generally can hide all of the warp threads so that you don't see this sort of thing. So that if you're making this and you're using a cotton warp, you can hide the cotton warp very nicely so you don't see that thing. And at the same time, you get the strength of the cotton warp, a fairly strong cotton warp. Again, this enters into the period, because we are talking about a period before the cotton gin. And before the cotton gin, you have a very hard time with cotton. You're not able to take the cotton out of the, separate the cotton from the seeds. Now, the Egyptians who used long fiber cotton used to do it with a couple of rollers. And rolling that, they would have the rollers very close together. They would pass the cotton through these rollers. The cotton fibers would go through. The seeds would not. That does not work on medium to short fiber cotton anywhere near as well. You can't do it. And so cotton is laboriously expensive process until the Eli Whitney invention of the cotton gin, which is nothing more than a whole bunch of circular saws, is what it amounts to, a whole bunch of little circular saws with little teeth that just rip the cotton out of that and do not take the thread, do not take the seed. In any kind of processing of natural goods, you clearly do not want to injure the fibers any more than you have to. And in the process of making wool, in the process of making cotton, anything you do that does violence to that thread, to the violence to those fibers, is to be avoided as much as possible. Obviously, the cotton gin is a machine that does a great deal of violence to cotton. But at the same time, it is clearly the only machine that makes the production of medium and short fiber cotton, short staple cotton, economically feasible. So, at this point, we assume that the Tankerson Cotton Company, in the mill that is just west of the pond, is now making cassinine. This thing was operated until, actually, that mill operated until about 1837 or 1838, when a probate court ordered the sale of the Tankerson Cotton Company at a public auction March 5th, 1938. A corporation called the Centerville Company purchased the assets for $16,516 and continued to operate the mill. And shortly after that, they went downstream from along the Tankerhusen, as I remember, a couple hundred, probably 200-250 feet downstream, put another very small dam, which was nothing more than a dam of loose stones across the Tankerhusen River to divert part of it into a head race that they dug out of the side hill. And then for several hundred feet, this head race went down. The river's going down like this. They take the water out here and bring it along level for several hundred feet until you get to a point where you now have a difference in fall or a difference in height between the head race and the Tankerhusen itself. At that point, then you can put a water wheel in here and then take the tail race then comes out at the, can rejoin the river at the river's level. And this is what they did. We're not sure exactly how the first building was built in the lower mill. We do know that the mill, as it was operated in the late 1880s, had the water wheel inside. Obviously, it in all probability had it there to start, but we're not sure because there's a definite break in the construction of the mill building between the mill building and the part of the mill that covers the stream, the head race that was right next to it, which is where the water wheel would have been. If you don't have your wheel inside, you're out of business as soon as the winter comes, because a water wheel, especially a wooden water wheel, overshot water wheel, will not operate very long in freezing weather. The water starts to freeze, and there's no water wheel made that will support the weight of the whole thing with ice, just solid ice. I assume that the head race itself did not freeze because there were no pipes, as a lot of Connecticut mills have. A lot of Connecticut mills have the dam, and then when they put the water wheels inside, they'll take the water out of the mill pond through a pipe underneath, put that into the mill itself, and then use that so that even though the pond freezes, the inlet and everything else never freezes, and they have water. There was never any pipe of this sort in the lower mill. So I assume that the head race didn't freeze over. But whatever. The company continued to operate the lower mill. Actually, at that point, we're making cassimere. They also, sometime shortly after that, started to make shoddy. And shoddy is exactly where the term comes from. It's the use of the used wool, if you will. The old man that used to come around and up and down the streets and buy old rags. What they did was, if you buy wool that has been broken into cloth, old clothing that is no longer used, anything of that kind, you can pull that stuff apart, pull the cloth apart, get the fibers back, and rework the fibers into a new cloth. That new cloth that you rework it into is called shoddy. The connotation of shoddy is because of it was stuff that had been worked once and was old rags is what it amounts to. But in the process of making shoddy, you need to remove, if you have any cotton warp or anything else in there, you need to remove that and get down to the basic wool. So what you do at that point is you put the cloth into a building, with hydrochloric acid and high heat, and this carbonizes the vegetable fibers out of the cloth. It will leave the wool but carbonize the vegetable out. And one of the large buildings that was at the lower mill was a carbonizing room in which they did this process. And after it's done that, then you can go ahead and pull your fibers apart and start to remanufacture your wool. If you look at cloth today, you will find in your labels, you will find what percentage of remanufactured cloth. They don't call it shoddy anymore. They have a nice name for it. They call it remanufactured cloth. That is shoddy. The same stuff. I should say, however, that most of the remanufactured cloth, not all, but most of the remanufactured cloth is in fact cloth that has gone through the mill and been found defective for one reason or another and pulled out of the process and sent back to start all over again. But when you get something that is remanufactured cloth, you better darn well know that the basic premise of treating fibers, and that is not to do violence to them, has been greatly abridged. Greatly abridged in remanufactured cloth. Shoddy was an economical cloth to manufacture, and it worked in this mill down here. The Centerville Company worked and made shoddy until 1866, when the mill was sold to the Dobson Whiting Company. And this is the last we hear of Peter Dobson. Peter Dobson, evidently, what had been the agent for the Centerville Company, which had been, even though his name didn't appear on it. But partners were listed and everything else, and there, again, the mill was sold in 1879 to Elisha Hilliard. He operated the mill for a while, then transferred it into a company called the Vernon Woolen Mill. The Vernon Woolen Company operated the mill from then until October 12th, 1909, when a fire actually destroyed the building, the main building. The main building was never rebuilt. It sat there. The Talcott brothers then purchased it in 1926, and they used to be at the lower end of it, in parts of where the working mill. There was a ballpark, or employee ballpark, for the Talcott brothers. I never did find out just exactly, was that there before, or did you people build that there?
The ballpark, I think, it was just an open space, yeah. And we built it as a ballpark.
You built it as a ballpark. So after 1926, that the ballpark was there. In essence, then, this is the history of the textile operation of both the Ravine Mill, which was the one that was near Dobson Road, and the Vernon, which ended up, and then the mill, which ended up being called the Vernon Woolen Mill, which was the one that is halfway down the ravine. It clearly showed the history of it from 1811 on to 1909 showed a lot of the development of the textile industry. They were eclipsed by the mills in Rockville long before this, and probably one of the reasons that the mills were never rebuilt in 1909 is because of the Rockville mills, the status of the Rockville mills at that point. Clearly the Vernon Woolen Company was one of the first companies that reprocessed wool in this area along the lines that they did in the Naval time. All right. I think that once that had been done, once we did our survey of that, we now have a historic resource that, as far as we're concerned, meets the guidelines set down by the federal government for their federal projects, and that is that since 1969, with the passage of NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, the federal government has said that if we're going to spend federal money on a project, I think the thing to do is to look at the impact this is going to have on the area that where the project is going to be, and see whether the project is more important or whether we're making too much of an impact, a negative impact on the area or what. Subsequent legislation has refined that to say very clearly that one does file an environmental impact statement, and as a part of that environmental impact statement, you must look at the historic and prehistoric resources that are in any project area before federal money can be spent. 1973, the state of Connecticut passed the CEQA, which is the Connecticut Environmental Policy Act, which mimics the NEPA very closely. The governor at that point decided that economic conditions were not good enough to warrant implementing this law, so that he never, very purposefully, never established any guidelines, or would not let his agencies establish guidelines for the implementation of CEQA. And this is where we got involved, and it was about that time that we saw the highway department kind of running roughshod over some, well, basically, initially prehistoric material, and said that the law is there to say you won't do this if you continue to do it, or if you don't set up guidelines to do it, to take the law into effect, we will sue you. And at that point, they kind of said, well, regardless of what the governor says, we better do this or we are going to be sued. And so they have. And I must say, after having been working with the Department of Transportation and none of the other state agencies for more than 15 years now, the attitude that a lot of people used to have that says, get the hell out of my way, my job is to build a highway, is changed very definitely. We now have people who are very much concerned with the environment, actually in DOT, actually in other agencies as well. We do most of their archaeological work for new highways and for revisions of highways, and it has gotten to the point where I, as an archaeologist, can actually sit here and say that I am quite happy with the way that Connecticut handles their historic resources and prehistoric resources. I think they do a good job of it. Yes, we make mistakes. Yes, there are projects where there are things there that we don't pick up. There's no doubt about that. But I think that's almost inevitable in any case, because the review process does not say that every project has to be done. It has to be flagged as being potentially significant in terms of its archaeological resources. That's what happened with the mills that we're talking about today, is that they were flagged as being potentially significant. One of the things that happened in 1980 when we did this, and in 1979 when we did this, would not happen today, is that once the DOT had determined that they were pushing their way out of the, away from the mill, they said that the, it was no longer their responsibility to do any of the archaeological work on the, to find out what the mills were or anything else, which meant that we, as Central Connecticut State University, State College at the time, but Central Connecticut State University had ran the excavations at the, at these mills with summer field schools, so that it was a, to be sure, the state funded in the end, but it was funded by the university, not funded by the DOT. They can't do that anymore. The legislature that passed since then says that they must, once they have determined that something, they had an impact on a project, they must go ahead and do that. The reason I bring this up is that I think that most of you people should be aware of the basic pieces of legislation that do exist. 1969 National Environmental Policy Act, whose property is on the National, listed in the National Register.